I'm Jay Crowther and welcome to the subscriber version of Inside Total Film. And thank you for taking out a subscription to the Smarter Movie Magazine. Are you enjoying the Top Gun Maverick action? I know we enjoyed putting it together. Today, I'm joined by our contributing editor, James Mottram.
Hello.
And our news editor, Jordan Farley.
Hello.
Hello, Jordan. This week, we're debating whether Fantastic Beasts, The Secret of Dumbledore, is magic or not. If the Lost City is a lost cause. Whether the outfit is a smart fit. And if all the old knives is sharp, and whether compartment number 6 is a 5-starer, we'll have to find out. But before we get on to those, what have you guys been watching this week? What else have you been watching apart from those films? Jordan?
I watched Apollo 10 and a Half, A Space Age Childhood on Netflix, which, if you don't know, is the new film from Richard Linklater.
Yes.
Snuck out by Netflix in classic Netflix fashion.
Just dumped it on there, didn't tell anyone.
Exactly. What are they playing at? So this is another one of his sort of rotoscope animated films, a bit like Waking Life and The Scanner Darkly. It stars Jack Black, who narrates the whole thing. And you've got Zachary Levi and Glenn Powell in there as well. It's set in the late 60s in Houston, Texas. By all accounts, it's a chronicle of Linklater's own childhood growing up in Texas at that time. It's a largely plotless account of what it was like to be a kid in Houston, Texas, for the most part. But the conceit of the film is that in the run-up to the Apollo 11 space mission, NASA constructed a test rocket to reassure Buzz Aldrin, Neil Armstrong, and Michael Collins that there wasn't any danger. But they built the cockpit too small, and it's only big enough for a child. So they recruit this boy, Milo, to go into space as a kind of test, secret test run that no one ever knows about. But that's sort of the bookend of the film. And the meat of it is really just what Milo and his large family get up to day to day, watching TV, getting their tongues stuck on ice lollies. It's quite charming, I thought. I found it really delightful.
How does it factor into Linklater's oeuvre? Is it on the decent end of it? Where does it sit?
Yeah, I thought it was really good. I really, really enjoyed it. As I say, it's largely plotless, so you will probably find that quite frustrating if you want to be told a story. But
you know that I'm going to find that frustrating, don't you, Jordan?
Exactly.
It's why this I sounds like it. Licorice pizza to me again.
It's definitely not licorice pizza. I think it's got more plot than licorice pizza, which I found very meandering. I have to say, I know that's not a popular opinion, but
it's my opinion, James. So I'm with you. We'll stand alone.
I'm not going to stand for this licorice pizza bashing. I thought licorice pizza was ace, and I really like Apollo 10 and a Half as well. I hope more people check it out.
Yes, I will do. What have you been watching, James?
I caught the first episode of Moon Knight, which I thoroughly enjoyed. I mean, obviously, I wrote the feature for Total Film an issue or so ago, but I hadn't seen a great deal of it then, but I thought it was a fantastic first episode. So I was really excited to see more of that. And then on Saturday, I went to the Prince Charles Cinema in London to see an old film, The Lost Boys, which unbelievably, I realised I'd never actually seen before, which is kind of criminal.
I know.
Well, I thought I had. And then I went there and thought, none of this feels familiar, which was great because it was such a great movie. But I can't believe how I hadn't seen it. And Alex Winter, who is obviously from Bill and Ted's, is in a small role in that. And he was doing a sort of marathon series of Q&As at the Prince Charles for lots of his films and came on and did a great Q&A as well for The Lost Boys. Revisit The Lost Boys or visit it for the first time if you've not seen it.
Oh, it's a fantastic, major, major film in our house. We love The Lost Boys here. And as you know, I've banged on about this enough in the office. I used to live in Santa Carla because I lived in Santa Cruz in Northern California, which is the town that is the setting for Lost Boys. So I have been on the boardwalk plenty of times in the hope of being told to stay off the boardwalk and have walked across that little trestle bridge, didn't drop off it into mist. Even found Grandpa's house up in the hill. So yeah, it's a big deal to me.
Nice, nice. Yeah. Death by stereo. What a quote that is.
Death by stereo, yes. It's a cracking film. I think I might watch it again. And also, great tune in that. I mean, obviously, there's the sweaty man playing the saxophone on the beach. Not so brilliant. But the thou shalt not, that little tune that goes with that film. Really cool. And Kiefer Sutherland is so cool in it with his mullet and his bleached hair and his big coat. Style icon.
I don't know if he's as cool as the two Coreys, though. The Coreys are fantastic in that film.
I mean, popped collars for Corey Haim there. The sort of jacket he wears with the pop collar is pure 80s, isn't it?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You've got some Frog Brothers sequels to look forward to now, James, as well.
Yes.
That's right. There are some subsequent ones. I'm going to have to work my way through the Frog Brothers oeuvre.
Yes, indeed. Okay, shall we move on then and look at what we can watch that's come out in this decade? It's time to find out if Dumbledore's secrets are worth discovering. It's this.
I'm sorry to disturb you, Albus, but I've just received troubling news.
Tell me, what is it?
It's Grindelwald.
Our time is closed, my brothers and sisters.
Our war with the Muggles begins today!
The world as we know it is coming undone. If we're to defeat him, you'll have to trust me.
Mr. Kowalski, we need you.
I said I want an out and I want out.
Ah! You do know I'm a witch, right?
Dumbledore asked that I give you something, Jacob.
So this is Fantastic Beasts, The Secrets of Dumbledore. Does he have any left? Apparently he does, Jordan. What secrets are we getting from Dumbledore here?
That would be telling, but needless to say, there are some, I think. I'm not entirely sure. Yeah, this is the third film in the Fantastic Beasts series. If you remember the second film, The Crimes of Grindelwald, that ended with Gellert Grindelwald amassing followers for a war with the Muggles, and the revelation that Ezra Miller's Credence Clearwater is actually a secret Dumbledore called Aurelius. Yes. So this film picks up shortly after all that in the early 1930s. Grindelwald has a new face, something which isn't really commented upon. He's played by Mads Mikkelsen now instead of Johnny Depp, who of course left in disgrace a couple of years ago. Grindelwald's romantic relationship with Dumbledore isn't subtext anymore. It's outright text in this film, albeit presented in quite a chaste fashion. So you get a lot of interesting scenes between those two, and those two sort of really drive the plot. Grindelwald is searching for an adorable doe-like fantastic beast called a Chilling, for reasons which aren't entirely clear initially and we won't spoil, but I was so pleased that a fantastic beast is actually integral to the plot this time around. Of course, having a beast central to the plot means that we have a reason for magizoologist Newt Scamander to be central as well. He's also managed to track down one of these rare Chillings. However, as we saw at the end of the second film, he's also decided to side with Dumbledore in the battle against Grindelwald. Dumbledore, as we know, can't move against Grindelwald personally because of a magical blood pact the two have. God, this plot is very convoluted.
I know, like, keep going. You're doing so well.
So he assembles this kind of ragtag team of Newt, his much cooler brother, Theseus. You have Newt's delightful assistant, Bunty, in there. Jacob Kowalski back, once again, played by Dan Fogler. And Lally Hicks, played by Jessica Williams, and Yusuf Karma, played by William Nadilum. So their mission is to stop Grindelwald, who we learn is sort of seeking to secure power in the Wizarding World, not through a show of force, but through a democratic process, as there's an election coming up, and he has chosen to run. And this mission that they're on is complicated by the fact that Grindelwald can see snippets of the future. So he has some inkling of what's going to happen. So Dumbledore's plan is one of confusion, where no one really knows what they're doing. Everyone's told to do things that they don't understand. Jacob is given a wand, which he can't use because he's a muggle and not a magician. The idea being that the characters and the audience are being kept in the dark in order to eventually get one over on Grindelwald.
So,
Jordan, I have to give you, I've got to give you 5 stars for that summary. That was
well done.
Brilliant.
Yeah, that is the thing of this, that there's a lot going on. It's incredibly complicated and intertwining. And if you've seen the trailer just makes it look an absolute mess of stuff being thrown around. Mm. Is the film more successful than the trailer led us to believe? Did you find it more satisfying? And could you keep a hold of all of those threads that are going on?
I know James will disagree with me on this, but I absolutely hated Crimes of Grindelwald. It was one of the worst blockbusters of the last 10 years for me. Just messy and pointless and didn't like a single second of it. But I had a surprisingly good time with Secrets of Dumbledore. I was genuinely surprised by how much I enjoyed this. As I say, they've reincorporated the beast in a way that I found a little more satisfying than they have in the past. And the fact that there's just this very focused single mission meant that even though there's a lot going on, there's a very clear through line. and you sort of never lose track of the way that they're moving forward, even if you're not entirely clear what they're doing in any given moment. And I found the characters just a lot more, I don't know, enjoyable to spend time with, in a way that it was able to keep my attention throughout, despite the fact this is quite a long film. It's close to 2.5 hours long. And even though, again, we won't go into spoiler territory, I thought the final sort of set piece, which is structured around this sort of election, was really quite tense and well put together, and, you know, has this gorgeous production design and flawless visual effects, which you sort of expect from the Harry Potter films at this point. But I thought they did a really wonderful job here. And Mads Mikkelsen is just so much better than Johnny Depp as Grindelwald, yeah. In my opinion. He's just so much more menacing and threatening and sinister. And there's this lovely dynamic between him and Dumbledore, I thought. There's a real sort of, there's a lot of fizzle going on between them, a lot of sort of sexual attention, despite the fact it's very chaste.
I mean, even straight out the gate, before, you know, like straight up, they're getting into a romance here, aren't they? The first scene is them talking with real heat about this relationship they had and this love that they had. And you can really sense it in these two actors. And I couldn't imagine then that Johnny Depp had ever played this role. Did it work for you, James?
As Jordan alluded to, I did actually like Crimes of Grindelwald. I did actually review it for the magazine.
Yeah.
Well, I was about to say, I think I'm in the 0.01% of the people that like that film. It was always a strange thing when you review something and you don't speak to anyone else before you write your review. And not that that should influence you in any way, but I remember writing the review. I think I did give it 5 stars. It's one of those where I look back and go, was a spell cast over me by Warner Brothers that day when I entered the theatre? I don't know. I haven't revisited Grindelwald, Crimes of Grindelwald. I'd quite like to, actually, just to see if I got it massively wrong or if I could stick up for that film.
Spoiler, you did.
Okay. All right. we've all got them in our back catalogue.
I gave The Hangover Part 2 4 stars.
It's not as bad as Part 3. Part 3 was worse.
Actually, it might have even been Part 3 that I gave 4 stars to. So we all have a blind spot. I don't know what I was on that day, but there we are. Carry on anyway.
But there we are. With Secrets of Dumbledore, I liked it to an extent. I thought it was really funny in places. I really like the humour of it. There's a great, great scene with Newt and his brother, where he's kind of rescuing his brother from a sort of cave. There's lots of little skittery scorpion. Like scorpions.
Genuinely horrible.
Oh yeah, quite horrible. And they're all on the floor and they're all skittering around him. And he does a comedy sort of, I can only think of it a bit like Egyptian hieroglyphics, that kind of little Egyptian dance or something that he does to sort of get past these creatures. And that was so funny. And at the same time, you've got the Niffler, his lovely little pet that's kind of in a cage and is trying to escape. And there's lots of little, it's like a miniature heist movie all bound up in that sequence. And that for me was a complete highlight of the film and comes at about the halfway point. And I found the second half very downbeat, a little bit dour in places. I mean, I think Mads is great. He does play it completely differently from Johnny Depp. I thought he was a little bit underused in some ways, but I'm expecting great things for him in obviously, you know, the fourth episode, whenever that will arrive. I did like it, but I didn't love it. We'll leave what I thought of Crimes of Grindelwald away from this, because clearly there was something wrong with my head that day. I like this, but I wasn't bowled over by it.
I don't want to sort of overstate my love of it. I would say for me, it's sort of a 3-star film. I think going in with such low expectations, I was sort of pleasantly surprised by how much I enjoyed it. Because there is still, for me, quite a lot of guff in here. Credence is back and he's just a character I don't really care for. Don't really enjoy Ezra Miller's performance as that character. Just he brings like the kind of dour energy to this film. He's a real sort of an energy suck whenever he's on screen, to be honest.
He looks really miserable all the way through the film, like he's having a bad time.
Well, he is having a bad time, James. I mean, come on, he's going through, you know, the trauma of family revelations. He's got like a serious issue with sort of rage and controlling it and all of the things. And he's caught between the light and the dark of the wizarding world. I think you'd be having a bad day, wouldn't you?
I would, but I wouldn't just mope around. He just mopes, basically. Yeah, I'm a bit bored of his mopey face, to be honest.
Just enjoy your last few days, you know? What are you so sad about? You're magic. Come on. I don't really like that character. There are a couple of plot threads that just didn't really do much for me. I didn't really understand, like, the whole queenie side of
it. What motivates her? I don't understand her motivation at all in these films. It's literally like they've given her this motivation purely to further this thread that they want of this love lost and the love torn nature of the relationship with Jacob. It doesn't.
Jacob is fantastic though. I thought he was great in this film, and his through line of trying to get her back was really what kept me going in that second half. I really enjoyed his performance, particularly in this film.
Yes. You mentioned Professor Hicks had a very small part in the previous film, but it's much bigger here. And thank goodness, she is so dry in her delivery. And I loved, I don't know what that cadence, that accent she was doing was. It's just, I loved it. I just could listen to her all day. And I really enjoyed what she brought to the party here. Did you?
She's a really strong addition or expansion, I suppose we could say. Same with Bunty as well. I thought Bunty was fantastic in this and really, really added something. Just her sort of slight mooning after Newt really, really worked very well. And she's quite fundamental in this sort of, well, it's not exactly a heist plot, but this sort of, as Jordan said, this ragtag kind of team out to stop Grindelwald. She's kind of fundamental in that plot in what she does. So I really enjoyed her as well. So they really worked well in terms of expanding those characters that had only had small parts in the previous films.
Yeah. And the chillin' is a delightful thing, isn't it?
Oh, just adorable. Yeah.
It's like a sort of with scales, with sort of feathery bits, sort of, what is it? I don't know what combination.
A magical Bambi, basically.
Yes, a magical Bambi. That is what it is.
Yeah, adorable, absolutely adorable. There's some other great creatures as well. You mentioned the kind of scorpion monster, which I thought was great. And there's this kind of bird who, I guess, inflates into a hot air balloon. I thought he was awesome as well. Absolutely loved him.
Well, yeah, for a film that does have fantastic beasts in the title, it was, as you said earlier, great to have A, one of them fundamental to the plot, and B, just a lot of other great beasts in there. I mean, I think that perhaps the previous film really didn't have a great deal of that. So they worked hard on that this time around to, you know, that is part of Newt's magical world, I guess. So, you've got to have them in there if it's in the title.
Can we talk about Jude Law's accent? What was he doing in this one? He started to put a sort of weird Cornish spin on it or something. Like his R's are very flat. And like, why has he suddenly started to talk like that? He didn't previously.
I think he's sort of transforming into Richard Harris, right? That's how I sort of took it.
Richard Harris ever speaking like this either?
In the same way that Ewan McGregor is, you know, gradually turning into Alec Guinness in the Star Wars prequels. This is what I imagine Jude Law is thinking, but I will agree it is quite odd.
It's distracting. You also...
It is, very much so. You also have Albus's brother in this, Aberforth, who hasn't been in any of the films before as well, played by Richard Coyle. He's even more grumpy than Dumbledore, believe it or not, and has an even stronger accent. So get ready for that.
Yeah, get ready for that. If you're into or not into accents, you've got a little treat there. And let's talk as well about the fact that, you know, this is sort of set against a sort of time when there was fascism in the world, in the Muggle world, and that's sort of reflected in this magical world. But also, it feels like it's come out at a time when we're experiencing this again with sort of, you know, current events. They obviously didn't know that when they started making the film, but it does feel like it feels more linked to our world than ever before, doesn't it?
Yeah, completely. Yeah. I mean, they obviously, as you say, did not plan for that in any way, but yeah, it's quite eerie, some of the sort of allusions you get in the film to what's happening in the world at the moment. You know, it's an accidental element of the film, but it does strengthen it, I feel. Just watching it, you do get a slightly unsettling feeling as to when you're watching Grindelwald and what he's up to and his kind of plans for sort of world domination, let's say. And yeah, it is quite scary as you're watching this sort of that element of it. I thought that worked really well.
Yeah, the sort of NATO of wizards trying to stop an oppressor sort of thing.
Yeah, I mean, there are scenes set in Berlin in the 1930s in this around an election where someone has a potential dictator is trying to seize power through legitimate democratic means. It's like, it's not subtle, but it is like quite surprising that they put this into a, you know, ostensibly a family-friendly film. The Nazi Germany parallels are pretty full on.
Yeah.
We should probably mention, as I think it's in the trailer as well, that there is a return to Hogwarts at one point, which I have to say, I mean, it was great to hear the John Williams music kind of pipe up at one point, you know, when you suddenly see the school. But I was a little bit disappointed with the Hogwarts sequence. It didn't really add very much at all for me. They weren't trying to do too much fan service in that, which is probably a good idea. But I was expecting a little bit more from that sequence, to be honest.
And you got Hogsmeade as well, and Professor McGonagall as well, turning up in her lovely green. So, yeah, that we do get sort of those nods to the Harry Potter side of things, but not a great deal.
Yeah, they feel quite token, to be honest. Not as magic as I would have hoped for. But, you know, they're there. If you love Harry Potter, you'll probably get a kick out of seeing these people in these places again. I'll tell you what I got a kick out of, though, was seeing Tony Erdmann himself, Peter Simonshek, playing the grumpy guard in the prison break sequence.
Yes.
I love how they just pull, like, these amazing actors from, you know, world cinema into this, you know, massive budget blockbuster franchise.
Yeah, I hadn't realised that was him until I read it afterwards. It was Tony Erdmann. And, yeah, that's part of the sequence that I was talking about earlier, the cave rescue sequence. And, again, he plays a really great part in that. He is definitely one to look out for in that film.
It felt like it had a little parallel to Dune as well, Jordan, that dance that you had to do to sort of fox weird animals. It's a bit like the sort of side...
Walk without rhythm.
Exactly. Yeah. There's a sort of element of this. So now I'm thinking that if this works in space and also in Wizarding Worlds, then this might be the way forward if I ever get attacked by an animal. Confuse them with a jaunty dance.
Is this some sort of TikTok thing? We're going to start seeing these dances on TikTok. And, you know, it's just a way of advertising these films in future. Yes.
The challenge is set, James. Off you go. So are we saying then with Fantastic Beasts 3, this is worth a go at the cinema? Worth seeing on the big screen?
Yeah, definitely worth a big screen. I mean, it's still a beautiful film to look at, as they all are.
Mm. Yeah, Fantastic Beasts 3 stars for me, but... still worth it.
Obviously not the 5 stars of Crimes of Grindelwald, clearly, but, you know.
Yeah, James, you're not allowed to review another magical world thing again until you've had just a cup of sweet tea and a little sit down, because I think you got overexcited on that. Okay, if you want to get overexcited about Fantastic Beasts, it's in cinemas on Friday. Right, speaking of Harry Potter, what's he up to these days? Well, he's in this.
Miss Sage, I enjoyed your book about the Lost City, and I believe you're the one who can help me find its treasure.
I have to respectfully decline.
I'm afraid I must insist.
Unchain me!
That's your seatbelt.
Loretta Sage is missing.
I'm gonna rescue her. I just want her to think of me as more than a cover model.
Let's start living dangerously.
Alan, what are you doing here?
We're here to save you. I'm certified CPR, I'm certified CrossFit. I have snacks.
After them!
So this is The Lost City. James, originally called The Lost City of D, changed entirely to The Lost City, not to be confused with The Lost City of Z. What's this one about?
I'm already confused now you've said that. No, so Sandra Bullock plays Loretta Sage. She is a sort of romance novelist. She has her latest book coming out. One of the real fantastic ideas here is that part of the success of these books is she has a cover star who's sort of been on all of these covers of her books, played by Channing Tatum. His character is called Alan, but the character that he represents from her books is called Dash. Very heroic name. At a certain point, quite early on after she's launched her book, she's kind of getting a little bit bored of her characters, and she's looking for something new in her life. And that comes along in the shape of Daniel Radcliffe, who plays Abigail Fairfax. He is a sort of eccentric billionaire type who's looking for sort of this mysterious treasure on an Atlantic island. And he basically kidnaps her because he believes she and her late husband had the sort of knowledge to find this item. When she's kidnapped her publisher or publicist for the publishers, played by Daveen Joy Randolph, she's sort of sets out or to try and find Loretta Sage. And along with that, Alan, Channing Tatum's character, he also, you know, feels like he must play the hero, goes out and to try and rescue her. He calls up a sort of person that he'd worked with, played by Brad Pitt, under the great name of Jack Traynor, who's this sort of special ops type who can go and hunt down these people. So Channing and Brad arrive on this Atlantic island, and they set out to try and find Sandra Bullock.
All hell breaks loose.
All hell breaks loose.
Is it good hell? You know, this is the sort of film that they don't make anymore. You know, I interviewed the directors for the magazine, and you know, they're saying they're quite happy to have Romancing Stone as a comparison because that's the sort of vibe they're going for, this big adventure romance. Do we need more of this in our lives? Does this convince you of that?
Yes, I think it does. I really enjoyed this. It's very much a film that they just don't make anymore, these kind of big budget romantic comedies. I found it very, very enjoyable from start to finish. Sandra and Channing have fantastic chemistry. There wasn't a moment where I didn't enjoy them together, to be honest. I thought they bounced off each other really, really well. Channing especially is incredibly funny in this. He's playing this just idiot himbo, basically, who's just a total prima donna. And, you know, he's walking through the jungle with his, like, pillow from his plane around his neck and things like this. Like, he's just that type of character, just completely incapable. There's a brilliant scene sort of in the middle where they wade through this river and Channing gets a load of leeches stuck to him, and his sort of reaction to having these leeches peeled off him, I was in absolute hysterics. I thought it was so funny. So yeah, I would absolutely be up for more films like this, more original scripts. It's a real shame that these type of films died out, and this film has done well enough that I think people might be encouraged to make more of them. And I sincerely hope that they do.
Did it work for you, James?
Well, I'm glad you mentioned that the directors were happy to have Romancing the Stone mentioned, because this is
It's exactly the same.
It's not quite exactly the same, but it clearly it does draw from that and the Indiana Jones films to some degree as well. Yeah, I mean, like Jordan said, it's a really enjoyable film they don't make anymore. I was glad to watch it. I didn't feel like it quite worked at the end. I thought the sort of MacGuffin that they're chasing after was a bit of a non-starter. I really did enjoy the Bullock-Tatum relationship. Brad Pitt's role is fantastic. It's really great to see him do that. Can't really talk too much about his role, but he was great in it. Daniel Radcliffe, also a lot of fun as the sort of eccentric type whose brother has taken over his company, and he's feeling rather left out, and that's why he's gone a little bit loopy and is chasing after this treasure to sort of satisfy his ego, really. The Tatum stuff, where he's kind of they switch it a little bit around from Romancing the Stone. So he's not really the rugged Michael Douglas type that we get in that film. He's really, yeah, he is a bit pathetic, but very funny in the role, very funny in the role. I just wished it had been that one notch better. Mm. But as Jordan said, you know, original films aren't coming along that much at the moment. So it was nice to see it from that point of view. And actually, if they did do a sequel, I'd like to see those characters back again.
Yeah, I agree with you, James. I had fun with it, but I sort of felt like it was slightly underpowered and it could have taken it up another level, because the talent you're working with here, Sandra Bullock and Channing Tatum, have charisma in spades, great chemistry. They're both really funny people. Radcliffe as well. Everybody's having a great deal of fun, and that sort of goodwill towards it is what got me along more than necessarily that the jokes completely landed every time. But yeah, it's a good time and I don't mind it at all, but I think it could have been a little bit more polished. And as you say, Brad Pitt, just a cracking cameo here, and a shocking moment happens with him that I literally did laugh out loud, and at Channing Tatum's reaction. And also you do get a little bit of a dance, just as in Romancing the Stone. You do get these characters having this little shimmy, but instead of the horror that is Michael Douglas's shimmying, you get Channing Tatum, who really can throw a lady around a village square to any kind of dance moves and, you know, make that seductive. I loved that element, that they really tapped into the strength of their stars and what they're really good at. And also the fact that it's good natured. There wasn't nastiness. So the nastiness could have been there with the Alan character, that he's an idiot, but he's a really gentle, nice idiot, and he really is trying the best. And he's just, you know, this whole scene when he comes on, the bit that I thought was the strongest is when Alan comes on the book tour to the fans, and does his poses and does his dances and has his wig on. He does it because the fans love it, and he does it with this best intention. And I just thought that was really nice to see a comedy that wasn't mean-spirited. It was just a really warm, nice comedy. So I like that.
Yeah, I did think the idea of a romance novel cover star was a really good idea as well, because I haven't really seen that in a film before. And I guess that is a thing, right? That, you know, someone can take a, can play a character on the cover of a book.
Well, Fabio,
all the way through.
Well, what's his, was it Fabio, that guy?
It's totally based on Fabio.
Yeah, Fabio used to do it until that seagull hit him in the face on a roller coaster. Do you remember that as a thing?
I have no idea what you're talking about. You'll have to explain this to me. I clearly don't read enough pulp romance novels, but...
No, it wasn't in a... It was a real thing that happened. He was on a roller coaster, and I think a bird flew into his face. I'm now going to have to Google that. I wonder if I dreamt this. I wonder if I was on whatever James was on when he watched the last...
Crimes of Grindelwald.
Yeah, maybe that's what's happening here. I'm going to Google it whilst you two talk about this. Yeah, you two talk further about the Lost City and the points you have to make, and I'm just going to Google that now.
Yeah, I was glad that they actually went to locations to make this movie. They shot a lot of it in the Dominican Republic, I understand, and for the most part you can tell. I would say it's let down slightly by a few very obvious sort of green screen moments, which was a bit of a shame because it just sort of takes away from the fact that they did actually go to a lot of these places to film. So that sort of let the side down a little bit. For me, the clear standout, we mentioned it a couple of times, but Brad Pitt's sequence is just absolute joy. Like, I just love that whole sequence. We should say as well that it's sort of more than a cameo as well. It's sort of a supporting role. It's definitely more than, you know, 10 seconds and he's gone. Like, I will say that. So you do get your money's worth from Brad out of this film as well. I wasn't entirely convinced by Daniel Radcliffe's villain, if I'm honest. He just plays into the whole MacGuffin element of the whole quest of this film, really. I don't think he brought enough to it where I thought he really stood out in the film. He just felt like it really could have been anyone, to be honest. I wasn't very surprised by what he was doing or what he'd chosen to do with that character. So that was a little bit of a shame. But
it's,
you know,
Harry Potter.
This is really...
sort of completely upending the sweet kid in Harry Potter and being this absolute, you know, somebody who could be one of the succession people, you know, like this media family that he's sort of this horrible little Burke that's just horrible to everybody.
Yeah, but we've seen him be a farting corpse in other movies. Like,
I had forgotten
just being a guy in a suit doesn't really cut it with Daniel Radcliffe for me anymore. Like, I expect more from him, you know. He's proven how great he is. That's what I want in every film. Sadly, this film didn't call for it, which is a shame, but not really the point of the film. It's really, you know, it's the Sandy and Channing show, and they're what you go and watch it for. And thankfully, both of them are really great. I very much enjoyed Sandra's sort of sparkly purple jumpsuit that she wears throughout the entire film as well. Just the most incongruous costume you can imagine for traipsing around the jungle, where she's leaving sort of glittery sparkles behind her wherever she goes so everyone can track her. I thought that was quite funny.
It's even the most incongruous costume for a publicity drive that she does, because that's what she's wearing it for at the very beginning. And I'm not even entirely sure why anyone would wear that to a book launch, but there you go.
Well, if you're going up against Channing Tatum in a wig, ripping his shirt off, what are you going to do?
That is true. There's a whole subplot involving Loretta's husband as well, which I thought was wildly unnecessary. Loretta's sort of dead husband, who she's still pining for, and they've sort of done all this research about this MacGuffin together. I really didn't think you needed all that. Like, I just thought Loretta and Alan slash Dash, their sort of will they, won't they, was enough for me.
Didn't you think that the husband story was because they were afraid to have a character, a female character, just be grumpy and a bit miserable for no reason? She had to have a reason to be so she was given this heartbreak in order to help you know, empathise with the fact that she was a grumpy shut-in.
Yeah, I totally understand why it's there. I just don't see a reason for it. Why can't she just be sad? Just let her be sad, you know?
No.
She doesn't have to be a widow.
No.
Just unnecessary.
She is allowed to be. Own your sadness, Sandy. Just be it. Mm. Can I just say, by the way, that I have discovered that Fabio, the cover model and hottie with the long hair, went on a roller coaster and a goose flew into his face. And he had blood coming out of his nose, and the the goose died. So that was an incident that happened, and that was real. And I don't know why that was in my head, but it was. It was at Busch Gardens in Williamsburg, Virginia, and their new Apollo's Chariot roller coaster. That was what happened on the first ride. So there you go.
Wow. Why has that not been made into a film? That would be a brilliant film. A model loses his livelihood because a goose hits him in the face on a roller coaster.
Lose his livelihood. Just came off the ride, wiped his nose, carried on, because that's the kind of guy Fabio is. There you go.
Does he have a face made of iron or something? How did this goose die and he just got a bloody nose?
It's very Zoolander-like, isn't it? Blue Steel or something. He could do a Blue Steel look on the roller coaster.
That's professionalism, you know. Goose flies into your face, you keep going. So we digress, but I think we're saying that The Lost City is worth a go at the cinema. Take your mates, have a good time, yeah?
Yeah.
Yeah, good fun. Really good fun.
Okay, so that is The Lost City, and it's in cinemas on Friday. And if you come back next week for the pod, Jack Shepherd will be sitting down for an exclusive interview with Sandra Bullock. And Jordan will be hosting next week. So that's two things to look forward to. Right, it's time for alternative line reading. And it has something in common with what we've just been discussing. Who is this? I'm going to do it in the style of a grumpy troll. I'm in a dress. I have gel in my hair. I haven't slept all night. I'm starved and I'm armed. Don't mess with me.
That was an excellent grumpy troll, I have to say.
That's not from Harry Potter, you're saying?
That is not, no.
Wow. Who said it? It was just so convincing. I know what this is.
What do you think it is, James?
I've no idea. I'm guessing something with Sandy, but I couldn't tell. It doesn't look like it's from Speed, so no, I don't know.
Your instincts are on the money. It's Queen Sandy in Miss Congeniality, of course.
It is. Well done, Jordan. And this is what it sounds like.
I'm in a dress. I have gel in my hair. I haven't slept all night. I'm starved and I'm armed. Don't mess with me. Ooh. Ooh. Whoa. I'm fine. I'm cool. I'm good.
Right. It's time to measure this one up. It's this.
This isn't art. This is a craft. You cannot make something good until you understand the customer.
Do we let all of our customers keep black boxes in back?
If we only allowed angels to be customers, soon we'd have no customers at all. Please, sir, I don't want any trouble.
I need you to listen carefully. There are 1,000 blue boys out there hunting for this. And if they find it, I start shooting, you follow? Making matters worse, there are 1,000 racket boys hunting for it too. And if they find it, they start shooting, you follow?
Don't want to be involved in whatever it is you do.
You know exactly what it is that we do.
So this is the outfit. Tell us, what outfit is being crafted here?
Well, it's a lovely suit. You probably won't be surprised to learn, as this film's set entirely within the confines of a tailor shop. So this is the new film from writer-director Graham Moore, who won an Oscar for his script for The Imitation Game back in 2014. It's set in Chicago in 1956 and stars Mark Rylance as Leonard, a British cutter. Specifically, he's not just a tailor, he's a cutter, who works out of his shop in Chicago with Zoe Deutsch's Mabel. Leonard's clientele are predominantly gangsters, hence the double entendre of the title, including Francis, played by a very menacing Johnny Flynn, and Richie, played by Dylan O'Brien, who is the son of a local mob boss. One night, Francis walks in with Richie over his shoulder, saying that Richie has been shot while reclaiming a audio tape which contains evidence of a rat in the family, and that no one's going anywhere until Francis finds out who the rat is. So this is essentially a 4 or 5-hander set entirely in the confines of Leonard's tailor shop. It's a chamber piece. As a result, it sort of lives or dies on the quality of the writing and the performances. And I would say for the most part, this is pretty solid. I enjoyed this. Very stagey, but very well scripted and very well performed. What did you guys think?
Yeah, I'd have to agree. The quality of writing is fantastic. And exactly as you said, it does live and die by performances and the dialogue. And then when you've got Mark Rylance and the mob boss you mentioned is played by Simon Russell Beale, another sort of absolute titan of British theatre, just to see those two on film together, sort of chewing over dialogue, that was a real pleasure for me. I didn't quite think the plot didn't quite blow me away as much as I wanted it to, but I still thought it was, as you said, a really solid piece of work. I mean, Rylance is just sort of immaculate in his performance, as immaculate as his Taylor character is in or Cutter, I should say, because that is a big distinction, isn't it, that he makes at one point. But as immaculate as his character is in sort of crafting his suits, it's just one of those really nuanced performances. You never quite know where you are with Leonard, and that really works in favour of the story. It was a really enjoyable piece, I have to say.
Yeah. I mean, it is stagey. You could imagine this on a stage, couldn't you? But it sort of plays like a bottle episode of a show, in as much as it's, you know, just confined. I loved Mark Rylance, but I felt like Johnny Flynn wasn't quite right for this. His accent wasn't quite right, and that kept pulling me out of it because I didn't believe he was a Chicago mob boy. He didn't convince me on that level, and everyone else felt just right for their roles. So that was the letdown for me.
Oh, I actually quite like Johnny Flynn in this. I didn't mind the accent at all, but, you know, each to their own. Stagey is sort of the optimum word in a way. It's one of those stories which is, you know, it's very twisty-turny. It's got all these sort of shifting allegiances and buried secrets waiting to be unearthed. Like, literally every character in this film has some secret that comes out within the running time. But, you know, I didn't find my attention wandering at any point, and actually being able to keep it contained to this one location with basically three rooms and that's it. I thought that was a little bit of a magic trick, that he was able to sort of keep it interesting for such an extended period of time. And I did like Rylance's performance in this. Didn't quite enjoy him as much as I did in Phantom of the Open the other week, which is, you know, his highlight this year for me so far. But I love the fact that he interned on Savile Row in order to play this character. He learned how to cut a suit along with the director.
Yeah, and that's him sewing those very exacting little, you know, sewing the inside of the jacket. And I love there's a bit where something is stained on a part of his suit that he's crafting. And we've seen the sort of time and the diligence it takes to get to this level of the suit, and the crestfallen look on his face that in the middle of this violence that's happening, that suit is going to have its sleeve redone. I sort of liked that sort of element of it as well. But there is a sort of, there's a shared DNA between, isn't there, Morris from Phantom of the Open and Leonard here, that they're both men who you think you know what they're up to, but actually there's internal mechanisms going on and secrets that they keep that lie beneath the surface that we sort of get an inkling of as the film goes along. And that sort of mystery that Rylance can bring to a character, that you never quite certain that you have a handle on them until he allows you to see that, is very much in evidence here.
As a character, he's very slippery, which I found really engaging. There's a moment where he's sort of joking about the fact that he might be the rat to Richie. And it's sort of one of those very convincing jokes where he's just winding him up, but you don't realize it's a joke. And he's doing this at a very precarious time where he could just be killed if they think he's telling the truth. And you would think he would know better. So I felt like I was constantly trying to get a grasp on who this guy was. Like, does he care about his life? Is he worried about the fact that these people are gangsters and could kill him at any time? He doesn't seem to be at points, but then at other times he seems very demure and he's just going along with what these people are saying. I like the fact that I'd never really had a handle on who he was until right at the end when I knew exactly who he was.
And then it was very satisfying.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, just to show his range, to go between the Phantom of the Open and the Outfit, it just shows what a kind of remarkable actor he is, really. I also thought Zoe Dutch was really good as Mabel, his sort of assistant. And they have a really sort of sweet relationship. But even that, again, is laced with sort of secrets as well, which works really in the favour of the story, I thought. Mm.
Okay, so I think we're saying this is another good one. This is a good week so far. This is one to see at the cinema as well.
Yeah, again, I would say solid. I wouldn't say it's probably not going to blow you away, but I would say if you want something a little bit different from a Friday night or a weekend at the cinema, I'd say this is actually well worth checking out.
Yeah, I keep sort of bouncing between 3 and 4 stars for this one, and I'd probably have to settle on 3.5 stars if we can go for halves.
Okay, we can. So if you fancy a go on The Outfit, it is out in cinemas on Friday. Okay, shall we go from one mole that needs to be teased out to another? It's this.
Vic has me looking into Flight 127.
So this is an interview. I thought you were here to see if we still had that old spark.
To old friends.
Oh, you can do better than that.
To old lovers. December 2012. Paint me Celia's picture.
I was living the dream. Then Flight 127 happened.
The hijacking appears to have taken the most tragic development.
Someone in our station betrayed us.
What about you?
They cleared me.
Really?
So this is all the old knives. James, is this about a cutlery box? What's going on here?
I wish it was. I wish it was. No, this is based on a book by Olin Steinhauer, who has actually adapted his own novel for the screen. It's directed by Janusz Metz, a Danish filmmaker who did Borg McEnroe and some episodes of 000, which wasn't a show that really got a big shout, but was a really good crime drama from a couple of years ago. And this is basically a sort of CIA intrigue story. Chris Pine plays Harry Pelham, a sort of CIA operative. And he meets for dinner early on with Celia, played by Tandoe Newton, who also worked for the CIA and was a former lover of his. And they're basically looking back on this operation that went down a few years earlier in Vienna. It was a sort of a mission to sort of stop this terrorist hijack, which went disastrously wrong. And as you just alluded to, Jane, there was a potential mole within their organization that caused this chaos. And Harry's job now is to sort of root out this mole and find out what really went down. And this dinner that they're having together winds all the way through the film, alongside an awful lot of flashbacks, as they sort of dance around each other in a kind of cat and mouse kind of way. And the story unfolds from there.
This is another sort of CIA operative played by Chris Pine. Better than Jack Ryan's shadow recruit, I think we can say, right?
I think we could probably quite easily say that it's better than Jack Ryan's Shadow Recruit. Poor old, that was perhaps one of not Kenneth Branagh's greatest movies, but Pine does these kind of roles really, really well. I mean, he feels like he's credible as a sort of, you know, as a sort of modern day spy. He's also in a film coming up called The Contractor, which is a bit more action, Jason Bourne orientated, but he's again playing in this world of espionage. But this is much more of he's called it his own sort of John le Carré kind of attempt at doing a le Carré story. And it has that sort of intrigue, betrayal, suspicion all woven through the story. Certainly better than Jack Ryan's Shadow Recruit. Although, of course, it doesn't have Kevin Costner, which I know is one of your faves, Jane.
Well, we were on or set Kira. Together, weren't we, of Shadow Recruit, James and I. We were supposed to be in Virginia, but we were actually somewhere in Surrey. And we went on set of that. And I remember Chris Pine was wearing the hell out of a sweater and was very, very nice. But everybody, including all of the personal publicists to the other stars, were dazzled by Kevin Costner when he rolled into the room and just switched on the charm. And yeah.
When you say everybody, you do mean you specifically, because I was dazzled too, but you know, I mean, not quite on the level that you were dazzled.
But he just was amazing, amazing. And one of my greatest set visits ever. I asked him if he was going to be wearing a white uniform because he was playing a naval character. And he looked at me and he knew exactly what I was thinking. I was thinking of No Way Out. And he said, "You like that, don't you?" And I thought, "I do. Thanks, Kevin." It was a great day. Anyway, we digress.
We digress. Yeah.
Jordan.
I was going to say, it probably doesn't bode well for all the old knives that we spent more time talking about Jack Ryan's Shadow Recruit than we have about this film. I thought this was perfectly fine. I don't have hugely strong feelings about it either way. I enjoyed Chris Pine in it. I like the fact that he's sort of aging into a more sort of dour kind of action man, very much as James says in the Le Carré mold. This is quite a somber affair, I would say. Something very, very tragic happens at the start, and the rest of the film is sort of dealing with the fallout of that. So it's not a film where, you know, people are dropping quips every 5 minutes and jokes. Like, it's not a laugh riot, certainly not. But a couple of really strong performances, Pine and Thandiwe Newton especially. A few other great, you know, people turn up, Lawrence Fishburne, Jonathan Pryce. But, you know, Pine really sort of drives this whole thing forward. And I thought he did a great job. I thought the story itself was a bit too meandering for me. It sort of nicks the structure from The Usual Suspects, basically, where you have a sort of story being told in one location and then flashbacks filling in the details and the rest. But it doesn't do it anywhere near as elegantly as Christopher McQuarrie's script for that film does. And I didn't find the events that surprising. I have to say, I saw the twist at the end coming an absolute mile off. Like, I don't even know how that could be considered a twist, to be honest. But I thought it looked great, really beautifully shot, some great production design. They're sort of sitting in this one restaurant for most of the film, and I would actually quite like to go for that restaurant. It looks lovely, some lovely views of the sea. But apart from that, it was fine. It all fell 2 hours.
I really liked this. I really liked it. I felt much warmer about it than you two. I really liked the idea of this sort of, you know, brief encounter aspect of it, that there's this relationship tied up into this traumatic event, and that there are loyalties and betrayals that are not only on a government level and a international espionage level, but on a, you know, affairs of the heart level. And secrets kept from lovers are different from secrets kept from superiors or from, you know, people you're meeting in back alleys with money in a brown envelope. I really liked that. And I thought that the sort of the play between Pine's character trying to interview this woman with all of the backstory that they had as lovers, I found that a really sort of different and interesting angle. And can we talk about the sex, please? Because this was hot. This was a sexy film, and the sex felt real and urgent and sad. And, you know, people were doing nudity, but it didn't feel at all like it was just being done to titillate. It felt like a real lived-in relationship. And I just thought if they'd had an intimacy consultant or whatever was going on, they'd really done it properly there. And it also felt grown up, and it felt that the woman wasn't just being used as an object within a sort of sex scenario. Hats off for all of that. My only thing that I didn't like was that it was all supposed to be Vienna, but it was all clearly made in London. So their HQ was clearly London. And when they're walking down streets, clearly London. And they're going, here we are in Vienna. And a bit of snow was flowing that somebody was madly waving off camera, but it really wasn't. So that on that level, that didn't feel authentic. But I just liked it a lot more than you guys.
You know, it's funny you mentioned the sex scene, because that's one thing that Pine has sort of brought up in interviews. He said that was his favourite scene to film, and he didn't mean that in a, you know, smutty way. And of course, he meant it exactly as you just said, as sort of, you know, it was a real character-driven moment in the film. And yeah, that's definitely one element to commend. I mean, I think it's well made. I found the flashback structure just a bit too convoluted. I couldn't really sink into the rhythm of it particularly. I liked the elements of it. I mean, Jonathan Pryce, you mentioned, Jordan. I mean, he's great in it. There's a great scene with him and Pine. I think it's in a pub, if I remember rightly.
Yeah, and pub.
Yeah, that is at least they could film that in
that
London.
It's supposed to be London, so we're all
they
right.
Probably went to Vienna to film that sequence, but no. It just didn't grip me as much as I'd hoped it would.
Okay, so, you know, I mean, between us, I think we're saying it's worth a go. I mean, because this is on Amazon Prime. This is a classy bit of TV to watch at home with your curry, I'd say.
Yeah, you won't need to leave your house, that's for sure.
And also, they do eat a delicious meal and drink wine. So I think probably you do need to have a delicious meal and a glass of wine when you're watching it.
Maybe several glasses of wine.
Just don't watch it with your parents or your grandparents in the room, because those sex scenes really are quite saucy.
In a very good way and an empowered way, we should say. Okay, so if you fancy that, it is All the Old Knives. We don't know why it's called that, though. That's another thing. Why is it called All the Old Knives? It's not like...
Because it's really about a cutlery drawer.
The mission isn't called knives. They're not old knives. No one has a knife. What does it mean?
Maybe anyway, a reader could tell us this next week. A listener could tell us this next week.
Yes.
Let's get Chris Pine on the phone.
We need to find this out. But do let us know as well if you have discovered why this is called All the Old Knives, because it hits cinemas and Amazon Prime on Friday. So you can watch it either on large or small screen. Okay, final film then. It's time to catch a train. It's this.
Нет.
Я из Финляндии.
А, как будет? Привет.
Hey.
Блин. Ну почему? Ну это же дебилизм.
This is compartment number 6. Jordan, what is compartment number 6?
Well, there's a compartment on a train, believe it or not. So this is from Finnish director Juho Kusamon. It's set in the 1990s. It follows a Finnish archaeology student, Laura, played by C.D. Haller. She's taken a long train trip from Moscow to snowy Murmansk to view some rare petroglyphs. She's supposed to be going on this trip with her lover, but she has opted not to go on the trip because there is clearly something rocky in this relationship. Instead, she's traveling solo, and in the compartment number 6, which she's traveling in, she has an unexpected companion who is this cranky, hard-drinking, chain-smoking Russian miner called Loha, played by Yuri Borisov. And on the journey, what initially starts out as something quite fraught and antagonistic turns into something a bit sweeter than that, something potentially romantic, but I don't think the intention of it is to, you know, show a burgeoning relationship. It's really just about their sort of friendship and how they grow, if not to love each other, but to really like each other. And it feels quite warm and lovely. So on the way to Murmansk, they have a few stop-offs, but the point of the film is then reaching this final destination, these petroglyphs, and there are many sort of roadblocks that they encounter on the way, or should that be train track blocks? I don't really know what they block trains with.
Points, failures, signal issues, whatever it might be. James, did you like this one?
On the tracks.
I did. Yeah, I did like this. It's an absolutely sort of life-affirming piece of work. Such a beautiful relationship between the two characters who are these sort of opposites that find some sort of common ground along the way. We were talking about Fantastic Beasts earlier and how that resonates right now with the sort of world situation. And I guess this film does as well with its sort of Russian setting. Just a beautiful piece of work, and got one of my favorite 1980s tracks that is repeatedly reused. I'm actually making a bid for this to be the outro music for today's pod. So this is Voyage Voyage.
Yeah.
I'm sure you both know that track. Well, it's repeated more than once in the film, and
yeah.
Strangely haunting track that seems to sort of, obviously she's on this voyage, but it does sort of sum up the journey that they take. It's just one of those really unusual, unique films. It doesn't come along very often, but when you get a chance to see it, really embrace it, I think.
Yeah, I mean, this was sort of in awards conversation, but didn't really go anywhere, did it? Should it have won more awards, or at least been nominated for more?
Finland submitted it, didn't they, as their Oscar nomination?
Yes.
I think it was an extraordinarily strong field this year, and I don't think this quite matches up to the likes of Drive My Car or The Worst Person in the World, but I think this is a really terrific piece of work. Again, it's just such, we've talked about quite a few films this week where it's really just two or three people who are sort of driving this film. This is another basically two-hander, with two people stuck in the carriage of a train for, you know, the bulk of the film, and it's really driven by just how wonderful their sort of relationship is, and the breaking down of the barriers between them, I thought was really quite profound and moving. I love the fact that he's just so like off-putting when you first meet him. He's absolutely
dropping
gross.
Fag ash all over her, and
in her
face.
There's like orange peel all over the table, and he says some really quite crass and horrible things to her, and you just think, oh no, this is not going to go well. And then just gradually chipping away at the armor and just seeing them come together and find this sort of unexpected middle ground, I thought it was really quite, just really warm-hearted and moving. And yeah, as James said, really quite life-affirming that, you know, even people who on first glance you just wouldn't think you could possibly get along with and just wouldn't want to spend any time with, you could found a really, you know, profound connection with.
What do you think about the fact that obviously this is Russian guy, and this is coming out at a time when, you know, there's a lot of anti-Russian sentiment. Is it quite interesting that it's coming out about now?
Really interesting. I hope it doesn't put people off going to see it, because, you know, it obviously doesn't have anything to do with the current, you know, Russia-Ukraine situation. As Jordan said, it's set in the 90s, but I think the book it's based on was actually set in the late 80s. I might be wrong about that, but, you know, sort of before the dismantling of the Soviet Union. And, you know, in the end, it's not a film that's about politics. It's not about what we think about Russian people. You know, it has a Russian character and a Finnish character, and they find, as I said earlier, they find some common ground. And I don't think the current situation that the world is facing, that should put people off coming to watch this, because it is a really beautiful piece of work.
Indeed. Okay, if you fancy seeing a really beautiful piece of work, that is Compartment Number 6, and it's out in cinemas from Friday. So that's all we've got time for films. What is your film of the week, Jordan?
I would probably go with Compartment Number 6 over everything, but as I say, pleasantly surprised by Fantastic Beasts, and I think if you go to see that this weekend, you probably won't be disappointed.
James?
Yeah, I'll go for Compartment Number 6 as well, but with a little shout out to The Outfit, which I did enjoy.
Mm. Well, I'm going to go for All the Old Knives. I just think you should watch that and see how a sex scene tells you all about betrayal and the things that have happened to those characters with just rolling around in bed. I think it's good. I do. Sorry. So we've just got time then for a reader's question. Are you ready for this one? If you had to spend the night in a movie haunted house, which one would it be? Jordan?
Can I pick a movie haunted hotel?
Sure.
Because I want to go for The Overlook from The Shining, of course. I mean, like, there's no good answer to this, really, is there? Because you're just going to have a terrible night wherever you go. You're going to be chased through the corridors.
But would you, though? Because, like, if, as long as you avoided the room and you didn't go to the bar, would you be all right? I don't know.
Just stay in the main hall. Just get your typewriter out. You'll be fine.
You're going to bump into the twins, whichever corridor you turn down. True. So you don't have much hope of escaping the horrors of The Overlook, but it's a beautiful building. Like, I think it'd be great just to soak in the atmosphere, take a look at the architecture. Obviously, great there's views. A lovely drive up there as well. Yeah, I think it'd be worth it. It'd be worth the torment, you know, someone bashing down your door with an axe.
All right. James, where are you staying?
Well, I'd either go for the house in The Evil Dead, because that's bloody scary, or if I wanted to be not scared, I'll go for the house in the 1999 remake of The Haunting with the Yann de Bont film, which is the least scary film I've ever seen, one of the worst films I've ever seen as well. So I can at least not be scared while I'm in that house.
I think I'd go for the house in Beetlejuice. Lovely white clapboard, classic sort of New England house, but with, you know, quite an interesting ghost that I don't find scary, but I find entertaining. So that might be quite a nice evening with him. I'd also really like it if that man from the waiting room with the tiny shrunken head turned up, because I just love him. I'd just like him to just cruise by the lounge whilst I'm having, you know, a little bit of quiet time. See the shrunken head man.
There is supposed to be a sequel coming, isn't there?
Yes.
Are you excited?
I'm always worried, aren't you?
Obviously. Always worried. Especially if it's a film that was made 30 odd years ago, and the Coming to America sort of syndrome.
Yes, but then you could have a Ghostbusters Afterlife, which I really enjoyed and thought they leaned into sort of all the nostalgia and warmth of that really well. So maybe Beetlejuice will be sort of edgy, snarky, embittered little loveliness that I love from the original.
Keaton still got it right. He could do it. No,
totally
problem.
Totally could. He's brilliant. Okay, so on that note, on our haunted house notes, let's see what we play out with, whether James has won with his Voyager. Is it Voyager or Voyage?
Voyage. You have to do the French.
Sorry.
Voyage.
Or whether we'll get some sort of spooky music. Let's find out now. Say goodbye.
Bye.
Bye.
Goodbye.
Now, let's turn on the juice and see what shakes loose. Voyage, voyage.